This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and today I take upon myself the solemn duty to do some hype debunking.
Ooh.
And we're not talking blockchain this time.
Yay!
We're actually talking about something that I like a lot, and is actually the reason I'm doing my adult education things that we talked about a couple of episodes ago. We're going to be talking about all things quantum, as Dave usually puts it in words.
Indeed, indeed. And this is something that I know very little about, apart from the very highest level of things that I skim across and my eyes glaze over, and I have no idea what all of these words actually mean. So this will be me asking lots of dumb questions, and Jon schooling me, and maybe all of you out there, as to what this is actually all about.
Oh, that's actually the reason that I proposed this subject for the podcast, because I want to talk about this stuff to people, and as you don't know enough about it to talk about it, if you do these episodes, after this, you will be an expert, just like me, and at least be aware of some stuff.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's quite how it works, but let's give it a go and see where
how far
we
get.
Exactly.
Coincidentally, we're setting this up, doing some preparation to do a couple of episodes on quantum. So this is going to be a little bit of a series, and you might even have some guests joining us at some point. But
we might, or we might not. You know, it's one of those quantum things, like it may or may not happen.
Well, at the moment, both are true. They both are and are not.
Schrodinger's guest.
Okay, that means you have to try and kill them with poison. I don't think that's a good way of getting...
We didn't kill them, or didn't not kill
them. We have to put
them
in a box with a poison vial, so...
Yeah.
Ethics.
I mean, you know, they can choose to chew on the poison vial or not. Like, we can't control that. Anyway.
Actually, the experiment doesn't allow for the cat to have free will, to be honest. But that's far away in the future, because, as I was trying to say before it got so rudely interrupted, or not, although, no, we observed that one, so yes, I got interrupted. apparently, the news kind of caught up with us, and a bunch of news articles have come out in the last couple of weeks and months, and it kind of serves now as a nice introduction to the series to just go to what actually happened in the news. Now, quantum news is typically something you only hear about when something major happens, or maybe rephrasing that, when some organization wants to make you believe something major happened.
Mm-hmm.
Or not. But if you're not really in the quantum world, if you're following this news, it's typically stuff that flies by without a lot of noise, because at the moment quantum is still very much in the research phase, and unless you're really deep into the stuff, you probably aren't keeping up with it. And that of course makes it easy for some companies to make a lot of noise and inflate their stock prices, I'm assuming, by just putting a bunch of words out there that nobody really understands. So step one, let's look at the news cycles. And I'm going back a couple of years to start, because that's where I kind of think the let's invade everybody's daily life with quantum stuff time started. And that was in 2019, when Google, in those days, the respectable research company, these days, a bit less do no evil. But they came out with a scientific paper about quantum supremacy using a programmable superconducting processor.
And quick question here, and I'm going to be doing this a lot, interrupting
yes,
you.
Please.
Like, is quantum supremacy an actual thing? Like, is this a well-known, sort of defined term?
It is a well-defined term, which doesn't mean that Google doesn't abuse it.
Right, okay.
But the idea of quantum supremacy is that, as I said, a lot of the quantum stuff is these days is totally in the experimental, scientific, trying stuff, throwing stuff against the wall, see what sticks kind of stage. Well, a little bit further than that, but that's basically the main thing. And they have coined the thing about quantum supremacy. It's a bit like the same thing with AI. They have a word for that as well. When AI becomes actual truth, it's the there's a term for it. It's
singularity?
Yes, the singularity. And basically, the quantum supremacy is kind of the singularity moment for quantum computing, meaning they actually have a computer that can do things faster than a normal computer. Normal computer being a computer you have in your house with the normal Intel or AMD processor, maybe an ARM processor from Qualcomm, something like that. And the quantum computer being based on the quantum mechanical principles of matter. Because at the moment, because we're still experimenting with this stuff, quantum computers, okay, I'm going to lie a little bit, but I'm going to say they don't exist. And it's a lie. Why? Well, there is hardware out there that is based on quantum chips, and there is hardware there. But a quantum computer, in my opinion, it is still not, because it's very much, again, experimental stuff, trying things out and simple things. It's not something you can use to just start programming things. But people are programming quantum algorithms a lot these days. But this is done on simulations. All of the hyperscalers, Amazon, Google, Amazon, they have these quantum computer simulation things where you can write quantum programs, which you don't write in C or Pascal or Java or whatever. It has their own little ways of doing things, incantations, I would call it. But of course, those are being simulated. You need a lot of memory, a lot of compute for that. And speed obviously isn't there because it's a simulation. So as long as we're doing it that way, quantum is not faster than classical computing at all. So quantum supremacy is not reached. And here in this paper, what quantum brought forward was not a lie. They actually had a little algorithm that they ran on a small quantum computer. And that was actually faster than a classical computer. So they were actually able to demonstrate a quantum program running in a couple of milliseconds, seconds, where a normal computer would take hundreds of thousands of years. Mm. Now, the thing that they didn't talk about at the time, and which is kind of important, is that the thing they did had no purpose. It was just an algorithm, a calculation they did, which was very much written for quantum. Definitely. I mean, not no problem with that. But it's not like they could now start writing all codes they wanted to on a quantum computer and make them faster than a classical computer. They just proved a single algorithm was indeed apparently faster in a couple of runs. So while, yes, it was a step forward, definitely, and worthy of the paper, saying you achieved quantum supremacy kind of means that if I take, a Lamborghini and I throw it off a high, very high building, I can say it drives faster than all other Lamborghinis. Yes, once.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that that's true, because terminal velocity...
Well, if you do full speed and then you drive off a building, but yeah, I mean, it should be in a vacuum, blah, blah, blah.
I don't know. I still think a Lamborghini could go faster than terminal velocity. But anyway,
The vacuum, there shouldn't be any air resistance. So, but yeah, I mean, that's exactly kind of the same connotation you have to take with this little. It's a big article, a big paper. But again, it's a good paper, and there's a lot of people involved with that, and they actually did something remarkable. But what happens, and that's kind of why I want to call this a debunking, dehyping episode, is that they always overinflate what they actually did. And I know why they do it. This quantum research requires a lot of money. This is not a simple thing. This is something like the Apollo project going to the moon kind of budgeting requirements. So they need to create hype amongst investors, and putting stuff like this out probably gave them a bunch of cash to continue working on this. So I can see why they did it. This one was kind of flying a little bit under the radar. It did pop up on some tech sites, but not a lot happened. So there was not that much confusion being generated. So while I guess it could have been better handled, it wasn't all bad. And again, it was a step forward, because it was the first time that we actually were able to prove all the theories. The question I have is, did we really have to prove it? Because the theories are sound. We knew that this was going to happen at some point, and then making this much noise over it. But again, money needs to be allocated at some point. So these kind of research papers do that exactly. So after that, things went quiet a little bit again. Everybody was working hard, and more companies are working in the quantum technology sphere, even in the Netherlands, where I am. We're actually a pretty big country when it comes to quantum. That's some reason why I'm interested in the whole thing as well. But then just before New Year's in December, Quantum came back with a update. They had their Willow chip. And of course, naming chips is a art. Willow, I kind of like. It's not a bad one.
Yeah,
doesn't make me think of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but that's Black's point. And the thing that they are talking about here is, again, an important one, because it's specifically talking about error correction. And that is something we go in more depth in subsequent episodes. But one of the big problems with quantum chips is error correction. And that's also why it's a lot of intentional hype when they say, we have a 50-qubit quantum computer. Oh, we have a 150-qubit quantum computer. Okay, that's okay, bigger. We can start doing things, right? Well, yes and no, because due to error correction, due to the inherent malleability of these qubits, if the phone rings in Singapore, your quantum chip in the UK is going to flip its bit, for example. It's very sensitive to any kind of temperature, electromagnetic radiation, things like that. And that's why to have a logical qubit, so a qubit that is reliable to program and read and do stuff with, you actually need a couple of hundred, if not a couple of thousand qubits. And right. That's why error correction is so important. And what the Willow chip actually does is make coupling, and I'm not saying it exactly correctly, I'm making it a little bit simpler to make it understandable, mm-hmm. but they found a new way of connecting multiple qubits together to achieve that error stability, that error proneness of the quantum chips. Instead of having to add thousands of them together, they found some ways of doing that in a more intelligent way. And it's a bit similar to how ECC works on memory modules. It's just partially hardware, how the thing is set up, and partially algorithmic to just figure out what's wrong and correct things if necessary. And they built something in the same idea. It's definitely totally different hardware, obviously, to make this work. But this is still a very small chip. I even forget how many qubits this one had, and they actually didn't talk about that a lot at all. But you see, 3x3, 5x5, 7x7, we're still in the very small numbers. But again, theoretically, this will have big, important advancements. And this is also the first article that really went into the main news, let's say. Google put a lot of marketing hype behind this, and some people are saying, oh, quantum is here, and from now on, next year, we'll have a quantum PC on my desk instead of a normal PC. And that was obviously huge oversimplification and overhyping of what's achieved here.
Yeah, I mean, there is a table right towards the bottom that says 105 qubits was this particular Willow system. There we go. That's the table. And it talks in a couple of places about how they measured the performance. They use the RCS or random circuit sampling benchmark. And one of my actual questions to you is like, okay, a benchmark's a benchmark, but like, is this also quite similar to the example you were giving with Google's previous iteration back in 2019, to be clear, you didn't actually mention the year. I think you inferred it, but this was December 2024, so literally just the other side of the year. Mm-hmm. And there is actually a graph a little bit lower than the table that actually shows the various different sort of benchmarks in a graph where you've got difficulty on the y-axis and commercial relevance on the x-axis. And yeah, kind of unsurprisingly, like the benchmark that they're using, the RCS or random circuit sampling benchmark, is very difficult, which is good. Difficult is good when you're talking for about benchmarks. But its commercial relevance and usefulness is actually the lowest on the entire graph. It's a completely pointless exercise. And so my question to you a little bit is, why on earth didn't they also provide some benchmarks for something, like for some of the other things here that, okay, aren't, you know, they talk about the level of difficulty on like the lowest, even the lowest level is beyond brute force, which to me is still quite impressive. Then you've got further up, you've got classically expensive. So, you know, months on a supercomputer, and then, you know, it goes up from there. And the thing I wonder about this, seeing the data, and, you know, lies, damn lies, and statistics, lies, damn lies, and benchmarking, I wonder if they showed the RCS benchmark because that's all it was capable of doing, and it wasn't actually capable of doing any of the other far more useful and still, you know, something that would take months on a supercomputer, if you could do that in, you know, minutes or seconds and something like this, would be incredibly impressive. So, yeah, that to me just smells weird.
Not just weird, it's intentional. Of course, I don't know. I'm not on the Google team. Yeah. I only read around it. But my take on this is that they built the Willow chip specifically to tackle this benchmark and nothing else. And there's a couple of reasons behind that. One of them, I think the most obvious one, is that anything that's useful requires millions, trillions of bits. And we're just not there, so we can't do that. I mean, the examples I give here for chemistry, for example, that's protein folding, things like that, will theoretically be way more performant on quantums, but with 100 qubits, even if each of them are error-free, which they're not, they were able to create 3 to 7 less error-prone qubits using those hundreds. You just can't write something that's commercially useful with a handful of bits. I mean, you can't even add two numbers together. Not that quantum computers should be used to add numbers together. Definitely not. Use a normal computer for that. But that's basically, I think, the first reason they did it. And the reason that those useful simulations do exist, those benchmarks, is because, again, a lot of this computation for quantum is done in simulations. Mm. And that's where these benchmarks, just to prove the point, basically, you can still, if you're writing your algorithms, quantum algorithms today in a simulator, you need to have some way of comparing them to each other. And that's where these benchmarks still have a very big use. So these benchmarks, the QC plus QMC, whatever, they are being used and they are useful. But when you're actually looking at the quantum hardware, the real stuff, again, we're in the very nascent stage here, and any kind of useful testing doesn't even make sense to think about, because there's just not enough viable bits to play with, qubits to play with. And obviously, for the marketing hype, if you're going to build a quantum chip to do some benchmark testing, of course you'll take the most difficult one you can use, because you know it's not going to be useful. That's a topic for another episode about useful quantum computing, but that's definitely not for today yet. So, well, in that case, if you can't go on the horizontal axis, well, let's go on the vertical axis and take the biggest one there. So I understand and respect the fact that I went for that one, because it would have made even less sense to take the photonic one, for example, which is low on both axes.
Sure.
And there is some marketing hype, because again, why do they do this stuff? Why do they publish this stuff? Funding, they need money for this stuff. And in this case, I think they made the right choice to just go for a benchmark that was feasible with the hardware they had and still was significant.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
It's a benchmark. Don't trust benchmarks. They're there to prove a point, not to do anything scientific.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just
all benchmarks.
It just, like, when I got to the end of this and sort of saw this graph, the whole thing just became far less interesting to me, because like to your point on, you know, debunking and dehyping and all that sort of thing, this is definitely an example of, like, you literally have to go all the way to the bottom of the article, like the only other stuff after the graph where it sort of exposes this. It's like, this isn't something that you know, I had to dig up or anything, but the only thing below it is the fact that they talk about, they've got a course on Coursera, and, you know, this is our quantum computing roadmap, and there's a like couple of paragraphs on that. So like it, they really do bury like this, like all the way down at the bottom of the article. And I can imagine like many, many people will have just got, you know, halfway through the article and gone, oh, well, this is really cool. And then, you know, not skip even. It on to the next.
Because this article wasn't used to publicize this achievement. This is the article that all of the marketing stuff referred to in the footnotes of the marketing articles.
God, it's even worse. Anyway.
But again, yeah. This is for investors. And all the investors need to know is Google doing good. Let's give money. I mean, that's the world we live in today.
Yeah.
But again, apart from that, and I do admit I'm biased. I do like quantum computing. I do think it will become very important probably a couple of hundred years after I'm dead. Which is sad, but I'm biased in favor of it. So I do it's how science research these days work. It's marketing, budgeting, getting the money, and it's without the money, you can't do anything. Yeah. And there's a lot of people on the horizon to try and take that budget from you. Yeah. But I think we should keep that for next week, perhaps.
I agree. So that either is or isn't. Who knows? All the time we have for today. Oh no, I've observed it. It is all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast, or maybe not support this podcast. Oh God, the quantum jokes / Schrodinger jokes are going to get really old really fast. So I promise nothing, actually. I promise nothing. You can support this podcast by becoming a Patreon. Every contribution really does help. There's no not helping here. We are on YouTube. You can go and observe that if you like. You can subscribe, hit the notification bell, comment, and do all the YouTube things. You can also go to roaringelephant.org for a link to our Patreon page. For more information about this podcast, send any feedback to podcast@roaringelephant.org. But until next time, my name is, or maybe is not, Dave.
And my name is Playing Dice with the Universe, Jon.
And we look forward to talking to you next week.
Goodbye.
See you then. Or maybe not.
Maybe this episode will never end. I'm just going to leave a whole bunch of empty noise, white noise at the end. See how many people really listen to the end.
That's
it. Terrible for the algorithm. So let's
put you on in the box. Put you on in the box. Put you on in the box.